Hi, I'm Amy Goodman. If you're tuning in right now, Democracy Now! Is probably your source for news you can trust. I'm asking for your support because, unlike the cable news shows or commercial media, our news hour is not funded by the oil, gas, coal, or nuclear companies when we cover climate change, or by the weapons manufacturers when we cover war and peace. It's funded by people like you and not like you, who share the value of free speech, deeply believe in independent media. That's what keeps Democracy Now! Independent. If you and everyone like you who tunes into this podcast made just one $10 donation right now, we could cover our operating costs for 2018. Really, that's all it would take. If you think like I do that the media can be the greatest force for peace on earth, make your tax-deductible donation today by visiting us at democracynow.org. Have a wonderful holiday season, happy New Year, and thank you so much. From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! In Honduras, the United States congratulates incumbent President Juan Orlando Hernandez on what it says is his re-election, just 1 month into a standoff between the Honduras government and the opposition front over the disputed vote tally, and days after the government-controlled election commission declared Hernandez the winner. We'll get response from award-winning investigative journalist Alan Nairn, just back from Honduras. His new story for The Intercept is headlined, U.S. spent weeks pressuring Honduras opposition to end protests against election fraud.
Well, Trump and the Republicans are attempting a rightist revolution with a massive transfer of wealth to the richest, locking in their structural advantages, attacking immigrants and the poor and working people. They've made tremendous headway, but at the same time, people are fighting back, and the outcome is completely up in the air. The November elections will go a long way toward determining whether the country makes a radical swing to the right now, or whether this is stopped, and whether we can prepare for a time where we start to get a more sensible
We'll speak with Alan Nairn about the stories that shaped 2017, as well as what's happened in Honduras. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Trump has signed into law the Republican tax plan, which will shower billions of dollars of tax cuts upon the rich and major corporations while ending a central pillar of President Obama's signature health care law.
So what's happening is we're going to sign this. This is a little picture of it. It fits nicely in the box. And I consider this very much a bill for the middle class and a bill for jobs. And jobs are produced through companies and corporations. And you see that happening. Corporations are literally going wild over this. I think even beyond my expectations, so far beyond my expectations.
That was President Trump signing the legislation into law Friday in the Oval Office. He's expected to personally benefit from a tax cut of up to $15 million a year. After signing the legislation, Trump traveled to his ritzy Mar-a-Lago resort in Florida, where he reportedly told his friends dining at the expensive private club, quote, "You all just got a lot richer," in reference to the tax law. The initiation fees for Mar-a-Lago cost $200,000, and annual dues cost $14,000. Experts say the $1.5 billion tax cut will overwhelmingly benefit big corporations, multimillionaires, private equity managers, and President Trump and his family, while hurting the elderly, low-income families, immigrants, people buying health insurance in the island of Puerto Rico. The legislation will also repeal the Affordable Care Act's individual mandate, which experts say will cause health insurance premiums to skyrocket. The bill also opens up drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. A recent NBC News Wall Street Journal poll found only 21% of Americans thinks the tax plan is a good idea. Its passage has sparked protests on Capitol Hill and in Los Angeles, where a psychologist named Robert Strong said he hand-delivered a gift-wrapped package filled with horse manure to the home of Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin on Sunday night, Christmas Eve, in order to protest the tax plan.
I didn't send it. I hand-delivered it. This new tax law that's going to kick millions of people off of health care and ultimately going to give the corporations tons of money at the expense of the average working poor family, I felt like I needed to do something that was equally absurd.
That was Los Angeles psychologist Robert Strong. The tax cut will be $1.5 trillion. Meanwhile, also in California, students and activists have launched a statewide campaign to gather signatures for a ballot measure that would reinstate California's inherited estate tax in order to provide free tuition for public universities and community colleges across California. They launched the grassroots initiative only days after Republican lawmakers voted to slash the federal estate tax as part of Trump's tax plan. This is one of the student organizers.
My name is Cynthia Diaz, and I currently attend City College in San Francisco. College for All is a ballot initiative that will make college tuition free all across California, which includes UCs, Cal States, and community colleges, by taxing the inheritance of the rich. It prioritizes low-income students, but it also includes undocumented students under AB 130, formerly incarcerated students, and non-traditional students, those who do not go to college directly from high school.
That was Cynthia Diaz, a student organizer with the College for All California campaign. The New York Times reports President Trump made derogatory and false claims about a number of different immigrant groups during an Oval Office meeting in June. Trump reportedly fumed about Haitians who had received U.S. visas, falsely claiming they all have AIDS. He also complained about Nigerians who had received visas, saying after they came to the U.S., they would never go back to their huts in Africa. Trump also called Afghanistan a terrorist haven. The White House has denied Trump made the derogatory statements. In Seattle, Washington, a federal judge has partially lifted President Trump's latest travel ban after the ACLU and the Jewish Family Service argued the ban causes irreparable harm and prevents people from majority Muslim countries from reuniting with family members living in the United States. The ruling by Judge James Robart came only one day after a three-judge appeals panel also ruled the latest version of the ban is in violation of federal law. The latest ban prohibits the entry of most citizens of Iran, Libya, Syria, Yemen, Somalia, Chad, and North Korea, along with some groups of people from Venezuela. The deputy director of the FBI, Andrew McCabe, is expected to resign within the next few months. McCabe was the right-hand man of former FBI director James Comey, and he briefly ran the FBI after President Trump fired Comey. McCabe has now faced months of escalating pressure and attacks from Republican lawmakers. Unnamed sources have told the Washington Post McCabe plans to retire as soon as he's eligible for full pension benefits. Over the weekend, President Trump took to Twitter repeatedly criticizing McCabe in a tweet storm that experts say could constitute witness intimidation. McCabe may be called as a witness in special counsel Robert Mueller's ongoing investigation into whether the Trump campaign colluded with Russia and whether Trump committed obstruction of justice by firing former FBI Director James Comey. Richard Painter, who serves as chief White House ethics lawyer for President George W. Bush, tweeted, "Using Twitter on Christmas Eve to intimidate a witness, McCabe, in a criminal investigation is not a very Christian way to celebrate the holiday, but it does make Mr. Mueller's job easier, and that's a nice thing to do. Merry Christmas," Painter tweeted. The leadership of Miss America organization has resigned after the Huffington Post published a series of emails in which the organization's CEO and its employees referred to the women contestants as the C-word and malcontents, called former winner Gretchen Carlson a snake, and shamed another former winner about her weight gain. In response to the expose, 49 former Miss Americas called on the organization's CEO, Sam Haskell, and other leaders to resign. Haskell and other members of the leadership then resigned over the weekend. The U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley, is claiming the U.S. helped push the United Nations to cut its budget for the upcoming year by $285 million. Haley's statement on Sunday came only days after President Trump threatened to cut off funding to countries if they voted against the United States' decision to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. Despite Trump's threats, the U.N. General Assembly voted overwhelmingly against the U.S. last week. In Yemen, residents say U.S.-backed Saudi-led airstrikes killed more than 70 civilians in a 48-hour period this weekend. The residents say the bombing killed women and children in the capital, Sana'a, and flattened buildings in other residential neighborhoods. Airstrikes also reportedly injured civilians attending a demonstration against President Trump's decision to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital. In Afghanistan, a suicide bombing in the capital, Kabul, killed at least 10 people Monday. ISIS has claimed responsibility for the blast, which occurred near an office of the National Directorate of Security. Human Rights Watch says the Syrian government and Russia have escalated their bombing campaign against eastern Ghouta, a suburb of the capital, Damascus. The rebel-held area has been besieged by the Syrian government since 2013. There are currently 400,000 people living in the besieged region, where supplies of food, water and medicine are in short supply. Protests have erupted in Peru after the president, Pedro Pablo Kuczynski, pardoned former President Alberto Fujimori, who was imprisoned for crimes including ordering massacres by death squads in the 1990s. He's now been released from prison. Many saw the pardon as a quid pro quo. Only days earlier, lawmakers aligned with Fujimori helped the current president, an ex-Wall Street banker, avoid being impeached on corruption charges. This is a protester speaking from a demonstration in Peru's capital, Lima, on Monday.
We are demanding Peruvian President Pedro Pablo Kuczynski's resignation and the reconviction again of this practitioner of genocide, Alberto Fujimori. Everyone in the Forge Morrison Aprista, the American Popular Revolutionary Alliance groups, really everyone in Congress, the Peruvian people are within all their rights to unite in a national insurgency.
In the Philippines, more than 200 people have died after Typhoon Tembin hit the southern region of Mindanao Friday. The tropical storm caused landslides and widespread flooding. At least 100 more people are still missing, and more than 50,000 people spent Christmas in mandatory evacuation camps. The storm is now heading to Vietnam, where thousands have evacuated. In more news from the Philippines, at least 37 people have died in a fire at a shopping mall in the southern city of Davao. All 37 were workers at a call center that was based inside the mall. Unions say the fatalities were caused by a failure to enforce labor laws, including workplace safety inspections. In the disputed territory of Kashmir, Indian troops have killed a man they claim was the commander of a Pakistan-based militant group. The news of the killing sparked protests in which at least six protesters were injured by Indian soldiers firing tear gas and pellet guns. This year has been the deadliest year in a decade in Kashmir, with at least 350 people killed amidst India's military offensive dubbed Operation All Out. Back in the United States in Texas, police shot and killed a six-year-old child only days before Christmas. The boy, Cameron Prescott, was killed when a stray bullet shot by a sheriff's deputy tore through the wall of his family's mobile home in a small city outside San Antonio. The sheriff says the officers were at the mobile home park after receiving a call about a stolen vehicle. Their deputies encountered a suspect, a 30-year-old woman, and opened fire, killing her and the six-year-old boy. The woman was unarmed except for a small pipe. The sheriff calls the killing of the child a tragic accident, but claims the deputies follow departmental policies. The Washington Post database says at least 952 people have been killed by police so far this year in the United States. In New York City, 27-year-old activist Erica Garner is in a coma after suffering a heart attack. Erica Garner is a nationally recognized anti-police brutality activist who's helped lead the struggle for justice for her father, Eric Garner, who was killed when police officers in Staten Island wrestled him to the ground, pinned him down, and applied a fatal chokehold in 2014. His final words, "I can't breathe," 11 times. Erica's mother says her daughter was hospitalized on Saturday after an asthma-induced heart attack. This is Erica Garner speaking on Democracy Now! Last year.
I protested. I've spoke on panels. I traveled across this nation. I exhausted all avenues. I even endorsed Bernie Sanders to get my message out. And it's like, we keep having a conversation. I exhausted for 2 years. And, you know, how much talking do we need to have? The Black Lives Matter movement been very compassionate, patient, and basically begging the nation. You know, we are under attack as Black people. We are being gunned down every day. And these officers are not being held accountable. And no charges from Tamir Rice to my dad to Freddie Gray, you know, has been.
That's Erica Garner speaking on Democracy Now! Last year. She's currently in a medically induced coma after suffering an asthma-induced heart attack. She gave birth a few months before. Photographer Don Hogan Charles has died at the age of 79. He's most famous for his photographs of the civil rights movement, including the iconic image of Malcolm X holding a rifle while peering out of the window of his home in Queens, New York. Charles was the first African-American photographer hired by the New York Times. He died earlier this month in East Harlem. And Christians around the world celebrated Christmas this weekend. On Sunday night, Pope Francis called for peace in Jerusalem and a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict during his Christmas Eve Mass.
On this festive day, let us ask the Lord for peace for Jerusalem and for all the Holy Land. Let us pray that the will to resume dialogue may prevail between the parties and that a negotiated solution can finally be reached, one that would allow the peaceful coexistence of two states within mutually agreed and internationally recognized borders.
Pope Francis's call comes amidst ongoing protests across the Israeli-occupied Palestinian territories after President Trump announced the U.S. would recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital and move the U.S. embassy there. An Israeli military crackdown against the ongoing protests has killed at least 12 Palestinians so far. During Pope Francis's Christmas Eve Mass, he also lifted up the plight of refugees worldwide and called for peace for the Muslim minority Rohingyas who've been the victims of a brutal ethnic cleansing campaign by the Burmese military.
I see Jesus again in the children I met during my recent visit to Burma and Bangladesh, and it is my hope that the international community will not cease to work to ensure that the dignity of the minority groups present in the region is adequately protected.
The UN General Assembly has voted overwhelmingly in favor of a resolution demanding Burma end the military campaign against the Rohingyas, grant the persecuted minority group full citizenship rights, and ensure the safe return of the hundreds of thousands of Rohingyas who have fled into neighboring Bangladesh. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show in Honduras, where on Friday, the United States congratulated the incumbent president, Juan Orlando Hernandez, on what it said was his reelection. This came 1 month into a standoff between the Honduras government and the opposition over the disputed vote tally, and days after the government-controlled election commission declared Hernandez the winner. Previously, the opposition front, the Alliance Against the Dictatorship, as well as the Organization of American States, have called for new elections amidst reports of widespread fraud and vote rigging, saying the victory was impossible to verify. Last week, opposition candidate Salvador Nasralla traveled to Washington, D.C. to meet officials at the Organization of American States, the OAS, and the U.S. State Department. But U.S. officials claimed he did not present evidence to back up his allegations of fraud. But on Friday, Nasrallah said his bid for the presidency was a, quote, lost cause after the United States recognized Hernandez as winner of the election. He told TV network France 24, quote, the situation is practically decided. I no longer have anything to do in politics, but the people, which are 80% in my favor, will continue the fight. This is Nasrallah speaking to the media Friday in Honduras's capital, Tegucigalpa.
The United States can recognize, like it recognized the electoral win of Juan Orlando Hernandez today via its State Department. But in my opinion, my opponent lost the elections by 500,000 votes, like I proved scientifically on Monday and Tuesday to the Organization of American States.
This comes as human rights groups have documented at least 17 people have died in demonstrations over the disputed election in Honduras. There are reports the military has assassinated and beaten protesters, including attacking protesters in the hospital, shooting tear gas into people's homes, including where there are children and pregnant women, and launching a violent crackdown against Afro-Indigenous Garifuna protesters. The U.S. State Department considers Hernandez and Honduras an ally in the drug war and immigration. Washington is Honduras's main aid donor and largest trading partner. Honduras was also one of eight countries to vote with the United States last Thursday at the United Nations against a resolution denouncing President Trump's recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital. Well, for more, we're joined in New York by Alan Nairn, award-winning investigative journalist who just returned Saturday night from Honduras. His latest story for The Intercept is headlined, U.S. spent weeks pressuring Honduras opposition to end protests against election fraud. Alan Nairn has won many of the top honors in journalism. Alan, you were in Honduras for several weeks covering this election. Talk about what's happened so far.
Well, it's, in a sense, an intifada of Hondurans against election fraud. But more deeply, it's a class uprising against an oligarchy that the U.S. has been backing for decades. The U.S. first used it in the 80s to stage the Contra attack against Nicaragua. Honduras was their base. Now they say it's being used for the drug war, but it's a de facto U.S. military occupation of Honduras in a sense, since the U.S. has an actual base there, even though foreign bases are prohibited by the Honduran Constitution. But as in, for example, the southern Philippines, where the U.S. also has military operating on the ground, there's a wink and a nod from the central government. It's very significant because Central America was devastated by massacres in the 80s, perhaps 200,000 killed in Guatemala, more than 70,000 in El Salvador, similar numbers in Nicaragua, backed by the U.S. With the help of Israel. And the societies have yet to recover to this day. The gangs, the crime, the drug trade are all direct outgrowths of those attacks on civilians. But first in Guatemala, starting a few years ago, with a popular middle-class-based anti-corruption movement that helped topple the U.S.-backed president, General Pérez Molina. And now in Honduras, with this uprising against what appears to be a stolen election, there's a revival. And an example, I think, for the U.S. And the world, that even people, when they're most beaten down, when many of their labor, their leaders have been assassinated, when many of their villages have been wiped out, as happened in Guatemala, they can still come back. The U.S. backed this election in Honduras of attempted re-election of President Hernandez, a re-election that is also prohibited in the Honduran Constitution.
You mean he wasn't supposed to be able to run again?
Yeah, but he did anyway. All sorts of evidence of fraud came out. There was a tape where his people were talking about Plan B for stuffing ballot boxes. There was a chat message, which I saw from one of the electoral technicians saying the fraud is now complete. On election night, the manager of the contractor counting the votes actually briefly put out a message on Facebook saying, Nasrallah, the opposition candidate, is the new president of Honduras. His lead is irreversible. And then they just shut down the vote count and resumed it later, announcing that that lead had evaporated and Hernandez, the U.S. man, was the new winner. Yet they had to wait 3 weeks before they could formally declare that victory because people took to the streets, hundreds of thousands of Hondurans all over the country. In many cases, some of the poorest people and working people in the streets taking the lead. And even many of the police rebelled. At one point, apparently about 20% to a third of the entire national police force had gathered in bases, refusing to, they said, to continue the repression, saying they were going to lay down their arms. In response, the military has promoted the leaders of the most brutal, most loyal units, the military police, and those who come out of the U.S.-backed Fusina training course to be the new leaders of the military. They're killing about one protester per day.
How many do you estimate have been killed?
It's hard to know exactly have been killed by the military. It's probably 34 or more at this point. It's in a sense an intifada in the streets, and a lot of the tactics they're using are also reminiscent of the tactics used by the Israeli military. Earlier, you mentioned the shooting of tear gas into houses, the systematic beating of protesters. But unlike in Israel, where the army is deeply ideological, fully indoctrinated to the project of the government, in Honduras, it's only certain sectors of the army and the police that have that character. I talked to many, many dozens of army and police, and it's clear that many of them don't really like being dragged along on a reimposition of the Hernandez government. And if these demonstrations can continue, it's not clear that this government can hang on, even with Washington's backing. And this is just a remarkable breakthrough, for not just for Central America, but for all of Latin America, but even on a world stage, because it's another example that the strongest U.S.-backed powers sometimes can be defeated. They sometimes can be rolled back, and that the U.S. grip in the world right now is weakening. And just the stamp of approval from the Pentagon may no longer be enough to hold on.
Although despite the widespread protests and calls from the opposition party, the Alliance Against the Dictatorship, and the Organization of American States for New Elections, and reports of widespread fraud and vote rigging in Honduras's presidential election, the U.S.-backed incumbent President Juan Orlando Hernandez declared himself the victor last week.
The acceptance of the will of nearly 3.5 million Hondurans will bring peace, harmony, and progress.
So that is Hernandez. And the first announcement, Hernandez saying that he won, was last Sunday, is that right? When Nasrallah, Salvador Nasrallah, of the Alliance Against the Dictatorship, who is ahead in the vote count before they shut it down, had gotten on a plane headed to the United States to meet with officials in the State Department. That's when Hernandez made his announcement.
Yeah, as Nasrallah was in the air. That's right. They did it to catch him off guard.
You saw Nasrallah as he was getting on his plane?
Yeah, he was not expecting the announcement to be made then, especially since just the day before, Hernandez's own sister had died tragically in a helicopter crash. So the idea was, well, he's certainly not going to do it today.
And she was his close advisor.
Yeah, she was his main strategic.
She was
President Hernandez's main strategic advisor. So they claimed victory. And then a few days later, the U.S. Came out and congratulated him on that victory. Another one to step in very early and congratulate him was Israel. And then A few days after that, the UN General Assembly had the vote on Jerusalem, and Honduras switched its past voting pattern and was one of the few countries to back the U.S. On moving the embassy to Jerusalem, thereby acknowledging U.S. control. And Guatemala, then under President Jimmy Morales, who came to office as the candidate of the old massacre generals who are now facing prosecution. Morales announced that Guatemala was moving its embassy to Jerusalem. It's part of a worldwide push that the U.S. State Department has made behind the scenes to try to shore up the Trump policy on Israel.
So before we talk about Israel and Palestine, which we'll do in the next segment more fully, to talk about Honduras, talk about the U.S. representative in Honduras. I mean, President Trump has failed to name many ambassadors around the world. But talk about who Heidi Fulton is and the role the U.S. has been playing in this election.
Well, she's the chargé d'affaires. She's the acting ambassador. And in recent weeks, during the protests, I've been talking to Nasrallah all along, asking him about his daily interactions with the U.S. And at one point, early in December, Fulton and John Cremer, who's a senior State Department official and a former aide to General John Kelly of the White House, met with Nasrallah. And he said that the U.S. officials were urging him to stop the protests. The protests were the one popular source of leverage against the electoral fraud, and the U.S. was trying to shut them down without success. Even though Nasrallah made a point of saying he wanted to be a friend of the U.S., he wanted to be an ally of the U.S., he said he wasn't going to touch the military base, he wasn't going to touch the multinationals. He even said he would sign every U.S. extradition order without even reading them. Despite all of that, the White House, where General Kelly is personally close to Hernandez, he's in a sense his political mentor.
And to explain who he is, I mean, to Kelly, before he was the chief of staff,
he ran the U.S. military for Latin America out of Southcom, Southern Command,
and then became head of DHS, Department of Homeland Security, before becoming Trump's chief of staff.
Right. So they decided even Nasrallah, who was promising all those things to comply with the U.S., was not good enough, was not acceptable to them, because he would represent a voting out of the coup regime. The 2009 coup, which had backing from the Pentagon and also from Secretary of State Hillary Clinton at the time, put in a series of presidents, of whom Hernandez is the latest, who back the oligarchy, give the U.S. a blank check to do whatever they want militarily, and who have very little popular support. Nasrallah keeps saying in a lot of his speeches, maybe I won 70%, maybe I won 80% of the vote. And that sounds kind of implausible for any politician to be saying that. But I have to say, as I went around Tegucigalpa and its outskirts, which is not considered a stronghold of the opposition, it was very hard to find anyone who had supported Hernandez. I concentrated on talking to what are usually the most conservative sectors, army, police, small business people. The security force people are not allowed to vote, but if you ask them how their family voted, they say overwhelmingly Nasrallah.
And they're not allowed to vote because?
To keep them out of politics. In many, many countries have that rule. There really is a great deal of evidence that this was a massive ballot box stuffing operation that almost failed because, first, they did not, the U.S.-backed Hernandez forces did not expect that the vote for Nasrallah would be so large. So they basically didn't stuff enough ballot boxes. They were shocked to find that even with their stuffing, Nasrallah was still ahead by 5 points on election night. So that's when the computer system was announced to have crashed and they shut everything down. And they came back apparently having fed additional fake ballots into the system. And only then were they able to get the result they wanted. But even that wasn't good enough because people were on the streets refusing to accept the result. Now the U.S. has come in and ratified it, even though the Organization of American States has said, you need a new election. This is not legitimate. But it's not clear today that even that will be enough, because if people keep returning to the streets, this regime could end up being very shaky.
We're going to break and then come back to our discussion with Alan Nair, an award-winning investigative journalist, one of many of the top honors in journalism, just returned Saturday from Honduras. His latest story for The Intercept is headlined, U.S. spent weeks pressuring Honduras opposition to end protests against election fraud. This is Democracy Now! Back with Alan Nair on Honduras and other issues in this end-of-year discussion in a moment.
Every night I live and die, feel the party to my bones. Watch the wasters blow the speakers, spill my guts beneath the outdoor light. It's just another graceless night. I hate the headlines and the weather. I'm 19 and I'm on fire, but when we're dancing, I'm alright. It's just another graceless night. Am I lost enough? Have another drink, get lost in us. This is how we get notorious.
Places by New Zealand Grammy Award-winning musician Lorde canceled her scheduled concert in Tel Aviv amidst activists' call to join the BDS movement. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. We're spending the hour with award-winning journalist Alan Nairn, just back from Honduras. At the United Nations last week, 128 countries defied President Trump by voting in favor of a resolution calling for the United States to drop its recent recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital. The final vote, 128-9, 35 nations abstained, 21 countries did not cast a vote. The eight countries voting with the U.S. were Israel, Guatemala, Honduras, the Marshall Islands, Micronesia, Nauru, Palau, and Togo. Trump had threatened to cut off financial aid to countries that voted against the United States. On Thursday, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley, reiterated Trump's threat after the vote.
America will put our embassy in Jerusalem. That is what the American people want us to do. And it is the right thing to do. No vote in the United Nations will make any difference on that. But this vote will make a difference on how Americans look at the UN and on how we look at countries who disrespect us in the UN. And this vote will be remembered.
In response to the UN vote, Palestinian politician Hanan Ashrawi praised the international community for standing up to the United States.
Well, I'm extremely encouraged that the vast majority of the states of the members of the United Nations General Assembly did not succumb to American threats and blackmail, and did not accept the Israeli insults being hurled at them. And they stood up for justice and for the rule of law and for what is right.
Former CIA Director John Brennan responded to the vote, posting a message on his new Twitter account, tweeting, Trump admin threat to retaliate against nations that exercise sovereign right in UN to oppose U.S. position on Jerusalem is beyond outrageous. Shows real Donald Trump expects blind loyalty and subservience from everyone, qualities usually found in narcissistic, vengeful autocrats, the former CIA director John Brennan tweeted. Well, as we begin our look back at 2017, we continue our discussion with Alan Nair, an award-winning journalist. Alan, your response to what happened in at the United Nations General Assembly, this overwhelming, defiant vote against the U.S.'s recognition of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, you watching this from Honduras?
Well, first, just in terms of what Brennan said, it's kind of rich for Brennan, the former CIA chief, to be talking about Trump violating sovereignty, because when Brennan was running the CIA, and prior to that, when he was a senior CIA officer in Saudi Arabia and the Middle East, he was backing the violation of sovereignty with drone assassinations. Trump has just added the extra element of being open about the fact that the U.S. feels entitled to attack any country. But that's a longstanding bipartisan policy, and Brennan helped to implement it for years. In a sense, he and the other old CIA and Pentagon men are now upset that Trump is blowing the cover and revealing the face of the U.S. To be as crude and ruthless as it actually is. In terms of the Jerusalem vote, the resolution was not as strong as the previous resolutions, and Trump apparently did succeed in frightening a few countries. The numbers who abstained increased to a certain extent. But Trump is just openly throwing in his lot with Israel. He's revealing what was always there, and he's talking about it. The U.S. claimed to be an honest broker between Israel and Palestine for decades, farcically supporting a peace process that was institutionalizing the Israeli occupation and an intensification of military brutality against the Palestinians. And now Trump is just being more open about it. There's a new book coming out from Norman Finkelstein where he documents meticulously the attacks that Israel has been waging specifically against Gaza and how these constitute prosecutable war crimes. And those attacks took place under Democrats, under Republicans. And Trump is just dropping the pretense of neutrality now.
And at the same time, the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., Nikki Haley, claiming the U.S. helped push the United Nations to cut its budget for the upcoming year by $285 million. Haley's statement Sunday coming only days after Trump himself threatened to cut off funding to countries if they vote against the United States on the U.S. decision to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. And, of course, despite the threats, U.N. General Assembly voted overwhelmingly against the U.S.
Well, yeah, this is part of a broader shift in the U.S. policy that this is an innovation by Trump. Much of the rightist revolution that's being implemented in Washington now with the unprecedented transfer of wealth to the richest, the attack on the environment, on labor unions, on the poorest people. That would have happened under any Republican president, because during the Obama years, the Republican Party became a radical revolutionary organization. But Trump does add certain unique elements. One of them is being open in his racism, being open in his embrace of the fascist idea of mob violence as a tool of politics, a unique ability to incite hatred and violence among regular people at the grassroots. So you see all these stories of school children being attacked as, you know, the other kids are yelling, Trump, Trump, as they're beating kids who are not white or maybe who they see as Muslim or foreign. And also in encouraging and inciting that kind of behavior among uniformed and armed people in the armed forces, in the local police across the country, in the in ICE. But on the world foreign policy level, what Trump carrying out the agenda of a narrow faction of the Republican Party is doing is basically trying to eliminate any institutions other than U.S. arms. make the Pentagon the sole tool of rule. So you strip away the State Department, you strip away the United Nations, and all that's left is the Pentagon and the CIA with their covert violence. And then in a supporting role, U.S. allies like the European governments, who, with his NATO policy, Trump is pushing to increase their military budgets. It's an approach that has upset a lot of the old establishment foreign policy types, because they recognized that diplomacy, that talk, that pretense, that hypocrisy can be very effective tools of power. But the Trump innovation is to say, no, screw all that stuff. We're going with straight violence and we're going with covert violence. And any other approach, especially those taken by groups like the UN, which not only represent A, diplomacy, but B, to a certain extent, the will of countries other than the United States and the will of the vast majority of the world's population, those have to be pushed aside. So they actually would like to, if they could, dismantle the UN.
So talking about the U.S. policy, putting so much into the Pentagon and also gutting the State Department, do you think there's a real rift between President Trump and Rex Tillerson, the former, you know, CEO of the largest oil corporation in the world, ExxonMobil, who reportedly will be leaving soon? And the word is, the rumors are, though many don't feel this will happen, that the CIA director Pompeo will replace him as Secretary of State. But one of the things he's been doing that would he would be in complete accord with Trump is absolutely gutting the State Department.
There seems to be some kind of rift. Who knows? But it in Pompeo, you have someone who is more in accord with Trump's approach. Pompeo is kind of another General Flynn. Flynn, who was briefly National Security Advisor, made his name working under General McChrystal out of Iraq and also with similar operations in Afghanistan, where they did what they referred to as manhunter missions, assassination missions, where they would go into homes in the middle of the night, killing people with complete impunity, with absolutely no fear of arrest or prosecution under local law or international law. Pompeo is an extension of that approach. This summer, he joked while speaking at the Aspen Institute about the past U.S. operations in Central and South America, which consisted of the support of death squads and military coups. And he seemed to be suggesting that he was in the midst of trying to put together some kind of operation in coordination with Mexico and Colombia to target the government of Venezuela. So Pompeo stylistically would be more in accord with Trump. But Tillerson completely agrees with Trump's project of gutting the State Department and massively increasing the role and the firepower of the Pentagon and the CIA.
And Pompeo, whether or not he's named Secretary of State, he is the CIA director and reportedly almost every day is with the president at the White House briefing him, has become very close to him.
Yeah. And one aspect of another aspect of the Trump policy is a lifting of the previous restraints on things like U.S. torture, U.S. killing of civilians in bombing runs, U.S. raids on civilian homes on the thinnest of pretense. Under Obama, the U.S. was killing thousands of civilians through drone attacks, etc. But there were some limits on who you could target and when. Those limits were the result of decades of lobbying by human rights and peace advocates. Trump has essentially stripped them away. During the last election, a number of people on the left were essentially sold a bill of goods on the idea that Trump would somehow be less warlike than the old establishment represented by Clinton, less aggressive, more some claimed isolationist. I mean, that was ridiculous on its face at the time. And as has been proven out, on every front, Trump has increased the deployment of U.S. troops, of CIA covert operatives. He has taken away the minimal restraints that existed on bombing and kidnapping. And in the case of North Korea, he's even now reportedly flirting with what for years was considered an insane catastrophic approach, which is a military attack on North Korea. It was reported in the British press a few days ago that at the White House they're contemplating what they call the bloody nose option, which would be bombing attacks on some North Korean things like North Korean missile launch sites on the theory that they could get away with it since Kim of North Korea would be afraid to retaliate by wiping out Seoul and South Korea, because they would then fear a U.S. nuclear holocaust for all of North Korea. Now, for years, this kind of thinking was completely rejected by all elements within the U.S. security establishment and by Democrats and Republicans in Congress. But now, under Trump and under General McMaster, who is sometimes touted as a moderate, it's back on the table again. So the idea that Trump would be less militant was insane from the start. And he's proving that blood is the tool. That's how he wants to reach out to the world.
We're going to break and then talk about the tax bill that was just passed and also talk about the movements that are resisting in this country. We're talking to the award-winning journalist Alan Aaron, just back from Honduras. Stay with us.
इस शहर में ओ कोई प्यार नहीं इस शहर में ओ ain't no love in the heart of the city ain't no love in the heart of town
ain't no love in the heart of the city by Zeeshan B, performing here in our Democracy Now! Studios in this end-of-the-year review. Every day this week, we'll be broadcasting musicians who've performed in our studio. Well, on Friday, President Donald Trump signed the Republicans' massive rewrite of the U.S. tax code, greenlighting what could be the largest transfer of wealth from the bottom to the top in history. Alan Aaron, investigative journalist, you've covered economic issues at home, especially the growth of inequality in this country. Can you respond to what has just happened and what this means as President Trump went then immediately to his ritzy private resort in Mar-a-Lago and told friends there in his private dining club, you will get rich from this?
Well, in a sense, the current governing group, the Republicans and Trump, in a sense, it's a coalition between the racists and the rich, the most extreme elements of both. And what this does, and they are a minority in the United States. The extreme rich are a fraction of 1%, and the most intense racists and anti-immigrant people are perhaps a majority of the American white population, but definitely a minority of the whole American population. So how do you govern if you're a minority in a national system that's heavily based on elections, where lots of decisions, not all decisions, but lots of decisions are made on the basis of elections? Well, you have to build in structural advantages. You have to have levers. The U.S. Constitution gives some of those levers. with things like the Senate, where small states like Montana and Idaho, et cetera, are able to send two senators equal to that of California, things like the Electoral College, things like gerrymandering of House districts, of voter suppression aimed at groups like African Americans and also younger people who might vote against the right. And one thing that the tax bill does is it adds yet another layer of structural obstacles to the actual majority in the United States, the actual majority of people who oppose the program of Ryan and McConnell and Trump and the largest corporations. It adds yet another obstacle, because of that $1.5 trillion being transferred, perhaps the largest transfer of wealth in American history, a large chunk of it is going to wind up in the pockets of either the rightist individual oligarchs, like the Kochs, like the family controlling Walmart, like Mercer, who directly fund their own independent political operations that spearhead things like voter suppression operations. And on the other hand, another big chunk of it, through the corporate tax cut, will go to the largest corporations like the Wall Street and Apple and so on, who will have that much more money to spend on lobbyists. So not only will it be an immediate money transfer, worsening inequality, while at the other end, 13 million people lose their health care and many thousands more will die as a result. But it also is a systematic increase in the political power of the radical right. So it's yet another obstacle that's been thrown up.
I wanted to ask you very quickly about net neutrality. This is a major moment with Ajit Pai, the FCC chair, the Federal Communications Commission, rolling back net neutrality, what that means and what is happening around censorship and the avenue of free expression.
Well, free expression and the chance for political dissent, a lot of which these days takes place through the internet, is in great danger, and it's under attack now from both the Republicans and the mainstream Democrats. The Republicans, with net neutrality, which essentially will give a license to the companies that control the internet to start cutting traffic to sites, shutting down sites if they want. And on the other side, from the Democrats, who have been using the Russia issue as an occasion to demand that Twitter, Facebook, Google, and others start censoring their posts. There were hearings a couple months ago in Congress, first in the Senate and then in the House, where the Democrats were holding up placards of false information that put out allegedly by Russia during the election. And they said they had the Twitter people there and the Facebook and the Google people saying, why didn't you censor this? Why didn't you stop this message before it could get posted?
The senators were demanding of the CEOs of Twitter
and Facebook. These corporations saying, Why aren't you doing political censorship? If you don't, you, the corporation, don't start doing political censorship, we, the Congress, will start having to force you. So you have the Republicans giving the corporations the means to do censorship, and you have the Democrats giving them a motive, a particular demand. And it's extremely dangerous. I mean, they could, if they wanted to, they could start cutting the traffic to the Democracy Now! Site. Already, Alternet said a few months ago that their own traffic was hurt when Google changed their search algorithm in response to these kinds of these pressures.
And 10 seconds on net neutrality on that issue.
Well, that gives the corporations the right to charge more for faster internet. So that means that people and sites with fewer resources can have less ability to reach the public.
I want to end with the issue of the movements that are pushing back, with Colin Kaepernick, who came to New York, accepted the Puffin Nation Prize for creative citizenship for having sparked a movement against racism and police brutality for, well, taking the knee.
I'd also like to say, at this point in time, with freedom of speech and freedom of press being under attack, in so many ways, in so many forms, the Nation Institute and the work that journalists and reporters are doing right now is more important than it ever has been. You truly are the pathway for the people to see the truth that's going on. So in this moment of time, my message to all of you is continue to speak just in an unjust room. Regardless of the consequences, regardless of the backlash, we're with you. We need that truth, and continue to spread that truth for us, because people need to know what's truly going on so we can game plan as far as how to fight against these oppressive forces.
So that was Colin Kaepernick, who can't get a job in the NFL because he took the knee protesting police brutality. From this protest to the Me Too movement, Alan Aaron, we just have 30 seconds. What gives you hope?
Well, the majority of people who voted actually voted against Trump on the popular basis in the last election are rejecting this attempt at rightist revolution. But they cannot succeed unless there's a massive mobilization that's persistent and doesn't stop because of all the structural obstacles that have built in. But in the November congressional election, if the Republicans can be swept out of control of the House and the Senate, and if people take
to
the streets
there,
like
Alan,
they did in Honduras,
this is Democracy Now. Thanks so much for joining us.